The Federal News Update for Saturday, December 13th, 2025. Hello and welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Johnson.
And I'm Sam Kennedy.
You, our listener, have tasked us with a monumental mission this week.
A huge one.
We're charting the sheer velocity of the U.S. federal government's actions on a single day, Friday, December 12th, 2025.
And this wasn't just, you know, a day of routine governance, not at all.
No, it was a 24-hour period just defined by aggressive executive action, fundamental judicial challenges.
And legislative brinkmanship. I mean, multiple existential deadlines all hitting at once.
We saw the White House use really every tool at its disposal. We're talking the Department of Labor, the Federal Trade Commission, all of it, to pursue its ideological goals.
That's absolutely right. Friday, December 12th was really a masterclass in the current state of governance.
Yeah.
It was a system just operating at maximum ideological velocity.
That's a good way to put it.
And if you zoom out a bit, the overarching narrative of the day was this fierce multi-front battle to define who holds central power.
Is it the states, the courts, or the White House?
Exactly. So we're going to walk through the operational, the legal, and the economic realities of the federal government as they closed out the week.
And we're going to focus on the specific nuggets of insight that explain how all these, you know, seemingly disparate actions connect to redefine American policy.
Look, could do it.
Okay, let's unpack this by starting where the momentum began, the executive branch. We saw what can only be described as a rapid consolidation of power.
A series of aggressive, unilateral regulatory and security offensives, all designed to, what, bypass or just neutralize the opposition.
And the most potent move, the one that hit the market immediately, was the full operationalization of that executive order signed late on Thursday night.
Yes. The one titled Protecting American Investors from Foreign-Owned and Politically Motivated Proxy Advisors.
Which is, let's be clear, effectively the regulatory front in the administration's war on ESG.
Environmental, social, and governance investing. Yeah, this is the big one.
What makes this so significant is just the sheer scope of the offensive. It's not just one directive.
No, it's a whole-of-government attack. Mm. And it's targeting the massive duopoly of Institutional Shareholder Services, or ISS.
And Glass Lewis & Co.
Right. And these two firms advise the huge institutional investors, think massive public and private pension funds, on how to vote on corporate governance issues.
And they control over 90% of that influence. It's a staggering amount of power.
It is. So the administration is framing them as a political threat, one that's using its market power to impose social standards on corporate America.
So how did they operationalize this? What was the coordinated strike on Friday?
It used three major regulatory agencies as key instruments. The first, and maybe the most impactful, was the Department of Labor, the DOL.
Okay.
Labor Secretary Lori Chavez de Remer initiated an immediate review, a review to determine if proxy advisors should be reclassified as investment advice fiduciaries under ERISA.
ERISA, that's the Employee Retirement Income Security Act.
It's the one.
Now, for our listener who isn't steeped in pension fund law, let's clarify that granular detail, because this is the legal key to the entire action, isn't it?
It's everything. If they're classified as fiduciaries under ERISA, these proxy firms become legally bound to act solely in the pecuniary, the financial interest of the plan beneficiaries.
So that means they would be barred from recommending votes based on what they call non-pecuniary factors?
Things like social or environmental goals that you can't prove will directly enhance financial returns.
So this isn't a suggestion. It's a profound liability shift.
It is. It's designed to make ESG-based voting just too legally risky for retirement plans nationwide. It effectively outlaws the practice in the massive U.S. pension market.
To underscore that point, if an investment firm recommends voting for, say, a climate change resolution under this new framework,
and that resolution leads to a measurable decrease in shareholder value, even a temporary one,
the proxy firm could be sued for breaching its fiduciary duty.
Precisely. The threat of litigation alone is enough to chill the practice entirely.
And this was happening simultaneously with actions from other agencies.
Yes. At the same time, the executive order directed the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, to take two major steps.
What was the first one?
First, it must rescind regulations, specifically Rule 14a8.
And for those unfamiliar, what does rescinding Rule 14a8 actually mean for corporate America?
Rule 14a8 is, you could call it the small investor's voice. It's the mechanism that forces companies to include shareholder proposals on the corporate ballot for a vote.
And those proposals are often on environmental or social issues.
Very often. Rescinding it essentially silences the activist shareholder movement. The proposals that the administration calls politically motivated would just disappear from proxy ballots.
Making it much harder for groups to hold large corporations accountable for their social or climate footprint.
Much harder.
And the second SEC instruction.
The SEC was told to consider requiring these proxy firms to register as full investment advisors.
Which sounds technical, but I'm guessing it comes with a lot of baggage.
A lot of baggage? Registration subjects them to much more burdensome liability, disclosure, and compliance regimes. Again, the goal here isn't necessarily compliance.
It's attrition.
It's attrition. It's intended to make the business model prohibitively expensive and force them to be extremely cautious about issuing recommendations that go against company management.
So you have a three-pronged attack.
You do. And finally, you have the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, directed to investigate the duopoly for potential antitrust violations or deceptive acts related to promoting ESG.
So a simultaneous threat of regulatory liability, financial liability, and a potential corporate breakup. It's a full-spectrum assault to eliminate ESG influence in U.S. markets.
That's the strategic brilliance and, you know, the severity of the action. And the fallout wasn't confined to Wall Street.
Right. The international reaction was immediate.
Immediate and complex. Glass Lewis is Canadian-owned, and ISS is owned by Deutsche Börse in Germany.
Wait, hold on. If the administration labels firms owned by close NATO allies, Germany and Canada, as foreign-owned and politically motivated, isn't that a massive diplomatic incident, not just a regulatory move?
It is, absolutely. It sends a chilling message globally. But beyond just the diplomacy, this sets up a huge regulatory conflict with the European Union.
How so?
The EU has codified extensive ESG reporting requirements under its own Sustainable Finance Disclosure Regulation. So this U.S. action threatens to bifurcate global capital markets.
So if you're a massive global asset manager,
you might now have to run entirely separate compliance and voting regimes for your U.S. holdings versus your European holdings. It creates chaos and massive inefficiency.
And the market impact was swift and measurable.
Oh, yes. This proxy advisor shock immediately injected political uncertainty into investment decisions. The S&P 500 fell 1.1% on Friday.
And a large portion of that was attributed to this move.
Directly. Asset managers started rotating capital out of ESG-labeled funds, fearing they could be targeted next by DOL enforcement actions. It showed the market takes this threat to the ESG framework very, very seriously.
That relentless push by the administration to control capital markets, it's really mirrored in their approach to border security.
It is. We leave Wall Street and pivot to high-stakes immigration enforcement, which faced its own legal and operational challenges on Friday.
And the first major action was an immediate legal counterattack.
A counter to the administration's new $100,000 fee on H-1B visa petitions.
$100,000.
$100,000. And this fee, imposed unilaterally by the executive branch, was explicitly designed to make hiring skilled foreign labor cost prohibitive for U.S. employers.
So a lawsuit was filed.
Immediately. A huge one. A coalition of 19 attorneys general, led by Minnesota, filed suit on Friday, arguing that this six-figure fee is arbitrary and capricious and violates the Administrative Procedure Act, the APA.
Their argument being that it bypasses congressional authority.
And that it's not a legitimate revenue mechanism. This is more than just a policy disagreement. It's an immediate crisis for the public and nonprofit sectors.
Because they're the ones who really rely on H-1B workers.
Exactly. Hospitals, particularly rural ones, major research universities, school districts, they all rely heavily on specialized teachers, medical staff, researchers. They simply cannot afford a $100,000 surcharge per employee.
So the lawsuit frames this astronomical fee as a de facto ban on the H-1B program achieved through executive fiat.
That's the argument. And it's starving these essential sectors of needed labor.
What's fascinating here is the political calculation. Is the administration willing to sacrifice the labor stability of critical sectors like healthcare during a shortage to achieve its goal?
Well, their actions suggest yes. They view this as a necessary step to encourage companies to prioritize and train domestic workers.
And in parallel, the immigration apparatus hardened its stance on physical entry.
It did. USCIS released a detailed memo implementing the expanded travel ban, now impacting 19 countries. They added Venezuela and Cuba to the previous list of 12.
And the crucial detail in this USCIS memo is the near total seal it signals. They removed previous exceptions.
That's right. Previous exceptions for educational and family-based visas are gone. This isn't just targeted sanctions on specific government officials anymore.
It's a near total block on entry from these regions.
It makes it virtually impossible for students or even family members of U.S. citizens from those 19 countries to secure entry visas. It's a shift from selective enforcement to blanket exclusion for these specified nations.
And then we also saw the administration leverage a high-profile public relations moment.
Right, with Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem delivering a speech claiming some really remarkable enforcement success figures.
Her update was definitely designed to shape the narrative.
For sure. She claimed 7 months of zero illegal aliens released into the streets of the U.S., coupled with a staggering 93% drop in border crossings year over year.
But the truly remarkable figure was the claimed scale of removal for the year.
2.5 million illegal aliens removed. That was the number she gave.
And the breakdown of that number is crucial for understanding the current policy structure. It wasn't all arrests.
No, not at all. That's the key. Only about 600,000 were detained and formally deported. The massive remainder, 1.9 million, were individuals who left voluntarily.
And Secretary Noem detailed how this was facilitated.
She did. Communication campaigns, providing plane tickets, and a $1,000 reimbursement for those who choose to self-deport.
With the option to apply for legal entry the right way someday.
Right. This financial incentive structure for voluntary self-deportation is really the defining characteristic of this administration's mass removal strategy.
And she tied this directly back to national security concerns, stressing the focus on terrorism.
She did. She claimed that ICE alone arrested and removed over 1,100 known or suspected terrorists between January and November of this year.
And she emphasized this doesn't count individuals encountered by CBP or other agencies.
Making a very strong public case that the enforcement surge is fundamentally about protecting the U.S. from threats, not just managing economic migration.
Yet, even as they project all this strength, there's some evidence that the administration is adapting its enforcement strategy.
Yes. And this is likely in response to negative public opinion, which we saw in those high disapproval ratings for the president's immigration stance.
So despite the aggressive tone, the operational strategy appears to be quietly shifting.
It does. We learned on Friday that they are pulling back from the large-scale sweeping workplace raids.
The kind you'd see at construction sites or large retail centers where hundreds of mass apprehensions occurred.
Exactly. They're moving toward more targeted enforcement operations, going after individuals who have committed serious crimes like rape and murder. They are, however, still aggressively engaging in traffic stop enforcement to run license plates and make apprehensions that way.
So the shift seems designed to mitigate the optics of widespread, arbitrary enforcement without actually reducing the total number of removals.
That seems to be the calculus.
And that tension between aggressive federal enforcement and the court's demand for due process was really brought into sharp relief by the ongoing case of Kilmar Abrego Garcia.
Absolutely. Garcia is the alleged gang member who was wrongfully deported to an El Salvadorian prison earlier this year. On Friday, a federal judge in Baltimore blocked ICE from re-detaining him,
citing a legitimate fear that immigration authorities might just take him back into custody hours after his release order was processed.
Yes. And Garcia's statement outside the ICE office, I mean, despite everything he went through, it was powerful.
He affirmed his belief in the U.S. as a country of laws, a country of justice.
It's a remarkable piece of theater, really, showing the human cost and the legal fight against these aggressive administrative actions. And what's interesting as well is the administration's continued fight for his removal.
They're still pushing.
They are. New information suggests they're now talking about potentially removing him to Liberia in Africa, rather than the previously mentioned Costa Rica. They're clearly determined to finalize his departure, regardless of the due process issues.
That same relentless push is mirrored in their approach to labor relations.
Right. The Department of Homeland Security was involved in yet another high-stakes battle on Friday, this one over federal workforce rights.
Specifically, the TSA collective bargaining repeal.
This is an extraordinary example of institutional conflict, because DHS is moving again to rescind the collective bargaining agreement, the CBA, with the American Federation of Government Employees, AFGE.
And that union represents 47,000 TSA screeners.
A huge number. And again, is the key word here. The announcement on December 12th stated that a new restrictive labor framework would take effect on January 11th, 2026, officially dissolving the existing 2024 CBA.
What's the justification they're giving this time?
The justification from Secretary Noem's office is that collective bargaining is, quote, incompatible with TSA's national security mission and impedes the agility required to secure the traveling public.
They frame union activity as wasting countless hours on non-mission critical work.
Exactly. Arguing that TSOs need their focus entirely on airport security.
But the context makes this a truly provocative move. This comes despite an ongoing court case,
where a federal judge already blocked DHS's prior attempt to dissolve the CBA.
Right. And the judge explicitly ruled that the earlier effort seemed designed to punish AFGE for having pushed back against the administration's policies in court.
So this new action is essentially throwing down the gauntlet to the judiciary.
The union response was immediate.
And furious. AFGE National President Everett Kelly called it a lump of coal right on time for the holidays, stressing that the timing was punitive, stripping their members of union rights just before Christmas.
And AFGE Council 100 President Heidrich Thomas pointed out the real-world consequence.
Yeah, that prior to the contract, TSA was plagued by dangerously high attrition rates due to hostile and unsupportive work environments.
So their countermove is highly political. They're urging the Senate to immediately pass the Protect America's Workforce Act, or PAYWI.
Which would restore those bargaining rights. And this is especially relevant because the House had just passed PAYWI the day before December 11th.
In a significant 231-105 vote.
That's the structural pivot point we should focus on. The House passes legislation intended to protect federal workers, and the very next day, the executive branch acts to defy the spirit of that legislation by dissolving the CBA again.
And this specific TSA action highlights a broader strategy.
It does. A strategy of the executive branch to categorize vast swaths of the federal workforce, from TSA to Veterans Affairs, as primarily engaged in national security, to justify canceling their contracts and stripping their labor rights.
Which sets up a perfect transition to the legislative branch,
where we saw similar high-stakes, polarized activity, particularly concerning energy and the economy.
We leave the domain of executive action and pivot to Congress and the looming deadlines that dominated the work on December 12th.
The 119th Congress, as you noted, managed to push forward a major bill targeting energy infrastructure,
but stumbled dramatically on a more comprehensive reform.
All while the crisis surrounding the Affordable Care Act subsidies just mounted in the background.
Let's start with the success. The passage of H.R. 3668, the Improving Interagency Coordination for Pipeline Reviews Act.
It passed the House 213 yeas to 184 nays, a stark partisan split driven solely by the Republican majority.
And this bill is a massive win for the fossil fuel and energy sector.
Huge. Its core mechanism is to mandate a lead agency, typically the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, to coordinate simultaneous interagency reviews from bodies like the EPA.
And it sets strict, non-negotiable timelines for that consultation.
The intent is explicitly to prevent the strategic death-by-delay tactics, where a single agency simply waits until the deadline passes, forcing a project to fail.
But the crucial implication here is the power shift embedded within the bill. H.R. 3668 moves the authority for water quality review.
Under Section 401 of the Clean Water Act.
It moves that authority from the states to FERC.
That's the real headline. Section 401 review is what previously allowed states, particularly those in the Northeast and along the coasts, to effectively hold a veto over multi-state pipeline projects by denying water quality certifications.
And the bill's sponsor, Representative Richard Hudson, made it clear this bill removes that state veto power on projects deemed of national significance.
The authority is centralized in Washington, D.C.
What's fascinating here is how this exposes a schism in conservator ideology. Here we have a bill championed by Republicans that strips states of their right to regulate water quality in favor of centralized federal authority.
I was just thinking that. House Democrats, like Ranking Member Frank Pallone, immediately hammered this point. He framed the bill as an outright assault on our nation's environmental laws and a shocking move against states' rights.
And Pallone also argued that FERC simply lacks the staff and expertise to properly enforce the Clean Water Act for thousands of miles of pipeline.
Suggesting the centralization will lead to poor regulatory outcomes, not just faster ones.
Okay, so right after that success, House leadership was forced to postpone the vote on the much more comprehensive NEPA overhaul.
H.R. 4776, known as the SPEED Act.
Why the stumble on a bill that supposedly all Republicans support?
The delay of the SPEED Act showcases the deep, often paralyzing friction within the Republican conference itself.
What's the issue?
The bill aims to radically accelerate all federal permitting by setting hard deadlines and severely restricting the time frame for lawsuits against approved permits. But the internal conflict arises because the reforms are technology neutral.
Meaning the hardliners saw a benefit they didn't want to extend to the competition.
Exactly. The neutrality means it would streamline permitting for renewable energy projects, like offshore wind and solar farms, in addition to fossil fuels and nuclear.
And conservative hardliners opposed this on ideological grounds.
They did, pushing for amendments to strip benefits from green projects, demonstrating a dedication to ideological purity that trumped the party's stated goal of pure regulatory deregulation.
This delay, while an internal political squabble, has real-world consequences.
It does. Especially considering the soaring demand for electricity in this country, industry pressure is mounting.
From who?
Lobbying groups like the National Association of Manufacturers stressed on Friday that permitting reform is no longer a niche issue. It's critical to meeting soaring electricity demand, particularly from the booming sector of AI data centers.
So the delay on the Comprehensive Speed Act means the broader need for grid overhaul remains unresolved, caught between development urgency and political infighting.
Precisely.
Speaking of urgency, the healthcare countdown dominated the late afternoon on Friday.
The Affordable Care Act, or ACA, subsidies are set to expire at the end of the year. This threatens to raise premiums for millions of Americans.
And House Republicans finally unveiled their alternative plan.
They dropped the 111-page Lower Healthcare Premiums for All Americans Act late Friday afternoon. It's an omnibus bill with three major components.
All designed to lower costs through market mechanisms.
Right. Reforming Pharmacy Benefit Manager, or PBM, processes to ensure better drug pricing transparency, providing limited funds for cost sharing for lower-income Americans, and creating more options for employers to use different cheaper healthcare markets across state lines.
But the single critical fatal flaw in the legislation is its omission of any extension for the ACA subsidies that expire on December 31st.
That omission ensures zero Democratic support. It guarantees the bill cannot pass the Senate or survive a filibuster.
So as a result, premiums for approximately 24 million Americans will very likely still go up.
Potentially by hundreds of dollars a month, at least in the short term, because Congress cannot agree on how to avoid the fiscal cliff.
And we should connect this back to the president's stance. He had weighed in on Friday.
He did, stating he wants the billions of dollars currently squandered on horrible Obamacare insurance companies to go directly to the people via health accounts.
Which he termed insurance accounts or healthcare accounts.
And he maintained that position, saying he would leave it to them, meaning Congress, to develop the legislation. He believes this direct funding model will empower consumers.
But structurally, it leaves the problem of the looming expiration entirely in the lap of a divided Congress.
A very divided Congress.
Yeah.
And the urgency is real.
House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries noted that the most direct path to avoid the expiration is a clean extension.
Needing only four Republican signatures for a discharge petition to bypass leadership and force a floor vote.
And he criticized Republicans for focusing on complicated partisan tax break legislation while letting the fundamental health care crisis loom.
And moderate Republicans are feeling the pressure. Representative Don Bacon of Nebraska, a moderate, supported the idea of a short-term extension.
But only if immediate reforms were included.
Right. He suggested a compromise might be lowering the income cap for subsidies to around $200,000, a sharp reduction from the current $600,000 threshold.
And ensuring funds aren't going to phantom accounts.
But directly lowering people's out-of-pocket costs.
Yeah.
The reality is that congressional punting is very difficult here, given the political volatility and the direct economic harm millions will face if the clock runs out.
Moving from the financial life of the individual to the future of the American economy, the administration spent Friday grappling with the federal push to consolidate AI regulation.
Sparked by an executive order signed late Thursday.
This executive order was explicitly aimed at blocking state-level AI regulations.
And the rationale, as the president made publicly clear, is that 50 different state approval processes would fracture and stifle the burgeoning AI industry.
Severely compromising the U.S.'s competitive position against China.
Which operates under a centralized national system. He stated that in the AI race, the U.S. needs to move as one.
The mechanism of this attempted federal preemption is aggressive. What exactly is the White House threatening states with if they push their own AI laws?
The EO threatens states with restrictive laws, with losing access to crucial federal broadband funds.
Which is a massive pot of money every state relies on.
Absolutely. And potential lawsuits from the U.S. Attorney General's newly established AI litigation task force.
The administration tried to soften the threat.
They did, by emphasizing they would only push back on the most onerous examples of state regulation, assuring the public they wouldn't stop common sense measures like kid safety requirements.
But this immediately met with state defiance.
It did, suggesting the White House miscalculated the political willingness of states to back down.
Policymakers in states like California, New York, Florida, and Utah are just charging ahead with their own laws.
They're scoffing at the order and vowing legal action against the administration for alleged overreach. New York Assemblyman Alex Boris, the author of the state's RAISE Act, explicitly called out the EO as benefiting the president's mega donors.
And this isn't just a Democrat-Republican split, is it? We see Republican governors pushing back, too.
That's the subtlety here. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, for instance, has an AI Bill of Rights in the works, focusing on parental controls and data privacy.
And restricting the non-consensual use of a person's image and likeness.
And Utah Governor Spencer Cox has also called for a MAGGI-backed alternative, focusing on protecting kids and American competitiveness without granting the federal government monopolistic control.
So this order is viewed by some on the right as an ideological challenge to the principle of states' rights.
That's right. So the administration is essentially claiming that AI is a matter of interstate commerce and national security, demanding the federal government set the guardrails first.
The White House counsel stressed that the Constitution makes clear that Congress is the appropriate entity to regulate interstate commerce.
And by inserting the phrase, "to the extent permitted by federal law," several times in the order, they are clearly setting the federal lane. They're arguing that the states are overstepping on issues deemed critical to national economic competitiveness and security.
This will be an instant high-stakes court battle.
No doubt.
And on a tangential but vital security note, the Pentagon is reinforcing the absolute need for digital security as AI reliance grows.
That's where zero trust comes in. DoD agencies are accelerating the adoption of zero trust architectures.
Meaning continuous verification of every user and device trying to access the network.
Moving beyond the old castle and moat perimeter defense, we saw detailed plans released by the Army, the Unified Network Plan, and the Navy, the Zero Trust Blueprint, on Friday.
Both laying out phased strategies to integrate zero trust across their vast, complex systems.
And this is being adopted internationally as well, which signals the importance of this shift.
Crucially, NATO has ratified the Zero Trust Data Format, or ZTDF, as an interoperable standard for secure cross-border file sharing.
It highlights the critical need for robust data protection beyond simple perimeter control, especially as data moves rapidly between classified and unclassified systems and between allied nations.
The push for AI dominance is directly tied to the need for secure, reliable data,
which Zero Trust aims to deliver universally.
That brings us seamlessly to the judicial arena,
which has repeatedly stepped in to adjudicate the constitutional limits of the executive branch's aggressive policies,
often utilizing the swift and controversial tool known as the shadow docket.
And the biggest constitutional crisis brewing involves the National Guard deployment showdown. The Senate Armed Services Committee convened a rigorous, often combative hearing on Friday
to grill DOD officials on the constitutional limits of deploying federalized National Guard troops to Democratic-led cities like Chicago, L.A., and Portland.
The core question is whether the president can federalize the Guard. That is, take them out of the command of the state governor absent a request from the state by citing the Insurrection Act.
And the key moment of the hearing
was when Pentagon Counsel Charles L. Young III refused to answer hypotheticals about the legality of ordering troops to polling places or other politically sensitive areas.
He insisted that the president has exclusive authority to determine if an emergency or domestic violence exists.
And that refusal was viewed by many senators as signaling a massive, potentially unchecked expansion of executive power over military deployment within the homeland.
And the Supreme Court is currently sitting on the razor's edge of this very issue.
Indeed. The Supreme Court is pending a ruling on the administration's emergency application in Trump v. Illinois.
The administration is asking the court to lift a lower court order blocking the troops in Chicago.
A ruling for the administration would establish a sweeping, dangerous precedent, granting the president unilateral authority to interpret insurrection or domestic violence to justify military intervention without state consent.
But the lower courts are not waiting for the Supreme Court to act. We saw immediate defiance from the West Coast.
Judge Charles Breyer in the Northern District of California issued a striking order on Friday, demanding federalized National Guard troops leave Los Angeles by Monday, December 15th.
He ruled the indefinite deployment profoundly un-American and lacking necessary constitutional checks.
This creates a deeply chaotic legal situation. A federal judge is ordering troops to leave LA while the Supreme Court considers the president's right to keep troops in Chicago.
The administration is expected to appeal Breyer's order to the Ninth Circuit immediately,
guaranteeing continued conflict in the coming days. The judiciary is clearly the firewall against the executive's aggressive domestic use of military force.
Beyond military issues, the Supreme Court issued two highly consequential rulings via the shadow docket on Friday, immediately reshaping civil liberties.
Let's start with Noem v. Perdomo. What did the court decide, and what are the immediate implications for the Fourth Amendment?
The court granted a stay, which immediately allowed ICE to resume using apparent ethnicity, meaning looking Latino, as a factor for immigration stops in Los Angeles, reversing a lower court ban.
Justice Kavanaugh's concurrence framed this as a common-sense law enforcement tool in areas near the border or in high-density undocumented populations.
Provided it is not the sole factor for the stop.
Right, but the dissent was scathing.
Arguing this goes to the heart of constitutional protections against unreasonable search and seizure.
Justice Sotomayor's furious dissent argued this ruling effectively suspends the Fourth Amendment for Latino citizens in the Southwest,
subjecting them to arbitrary detention and roving patrols based solely on their appearance.
She warned that granting such latitude to law enforcement degrades the fundamental rights of all citizens in that region. This decision immediately emboldened DHS operations, especially in California.
And the second major shadow docket ruling concerns personal identification and gender markers.
That was Trump v. Orr. The court stayed a district court injunction, allowing the administration's policy requiring passports to list only biological sex at birth and revoking the X gender marker option to immediately take effect while appeals proceed.
Again, Justice Jackson's dissent fiercely criticized the use of the shadow docket,
noting the policy inflicts irreparable harm on transgender Americans.
That irreparable harm, as she detailed it, refers to forcing people to carry government documents that contradict their lived reality,
exposing them to harassment, discrimination, and travel restrictions, especially internationally. It's a powerful critique of the shadow docket, the practice of issuing consequential, often poorly reasoned, orders without full briefing or oral argument.
Justice Jackson argued that using this mechanism to implement a discriminatory policy before the case is fully heard is an abuse of judicial process.
That's right.
This relentless pace of judicial action also manifested in a high-profile conflict over presidential pardon power on Friday.
The Tina Peters pardon conflict. This is an unprecedented situation. President Trump promised a full pardon to Tina Peters, the former Mesa County, Colorado clerk.
Convicted on state charges related to election interference, she was sentenced last year for facilitating unauthorized access to election software.
The problem, of course, is that the president's pardoning power only extends to federal crimes.
Exactly. Colorado Attorney General Phil Weiser asserted immediately that the president lacks any jurisdiction over state convictions.
He called the promise a lawless act and an act of intimidation aimed at undermining Colorado's independent judiciary.
So this sets up a profound legal battle. Is the president actively daring a state to challenge his power, claiming a form of executive supremacy over state legal systems?
It certainly appears so. The core legal conflict is simple. Does the state maintain its authority over its own judicial system? The answer from Colorado officials is a resounding yes, setting up a clash of constitutional norms.
If a president can simply promise away state convictions, the entire balance of federalism collapses.
It does.
As we transition into our final segment, let's cover the internal mechanics of the federal government, the administration, the economy, and the health of the workforce itself.
Right, because while the headlines focus on constitutional crises, the internal infrastructure is struggling to keep up.
Insights into the stress on the federal workforce highlight the debilitating levels of anxiety and burnout.
Following months of disruption, including layoffs and the massive 43-day shutdown earlier this year, stability is gone, and the constant uncertainty fueled by potential future shutdowns, causes a psychological survive response that severely limits performance.
And the resulting backlog is staggering, making the government's ability to function normally highly questionable for the foreseeable future.
It is. Experts suggest it takes 3 to 5 days to reset agency performance and process backlogs for each day of a shutdown.
Given the 43-day shutdown, agencies are facing up to 7 months of accumulated backlog and operational overcapacity.
So leadership is now scrambling to manage this by focusing on outcomes over process, prioritizing aggressively, and actively advocating for deprioritization to counter the psychological weight of the accumulated work. They need short-term wins just to reassure the staff.
We also saw continued instability at a key agency, FEMA.
A meeting of the FEMA Review Council, appointed by the president to recommend comprehensive reforms to disaster response, was abruptly canceled or postponed on Friday.
This prolongs anticipation over a much-needed disaster response overhaul.
The context here is political friction. President Trump created the council while simultaneously proposing to eliminate FEMA entirely.
And an initial draft of the council's report,
which was lauded for its careful expert input, was reportedly slashed from over 160 pages to a mere 20 by Homeland Secretary Kristi Noem's office.
Which suggests high-level political interference designed to limit the scope and depth of any reform that might challenge the administration's authority or budget priorities.
It does.
Shifting to financial management and federal real estate, the General Services Administration, GSA, was active in efforts to right-size the massive federal property portfolio.
But they're fighting decades of decay. The GSA terminated hundreds of federal office leases, but admitted this was far less than their internal targets. The core challenge is the sheer physical decay of the owned portfolio.
GSA faces a multi-billion dollar maintenance and repair backlog.
About $50 billion is needed.
To put that GSA maintenance need in perspective, $50 billion, that's roughly what it costs to build 15 brand new state-of-the-art aircraft carriers.
And yet the GSA receives only $600 million annually to address this massive structural deficit. We are letting the existing physical infrastructure of the federal government simply rot.
Exactly. And the scale of the problem is so vast that one board member of the Public Buildings Reform Board suggested the entire federal portfolio needs to shrink by about 80% just to keep up.
With the deferred maintenance backlog, which the GAO now estimates has more than doubled since 2017 to $340 billion.
And this all plays against a very hard deadline set by Congress.
Right. Agencies must meet a 60% building utilization rate by January 2026 under the USEIT Act.
If they don't meet that target, they must come up with concrete plans to relocate or shed space.
This pressure is driving the GSA's push for more leased space, where taxpayers aren't forced to pay for empty buildings that require billions in maintenance.
We also saw Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy launch a high-profile attack on state-level compliance,
specifically threatening New York State funding. Secretary Duffy threatened to yank $73 million in federal highway funding from New York State as a Phase 1 action.
This followed a Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration audit.
An audit that found a 53% failure rate in the roughly 32,000 commercial trucking licenses, or CDLs, issued to foreign-born drivers in the U.S. illegally.
And what was the specific violation New York was accused of?
Duffy argued New York was unlawfully issuing 8-year CDLs even when the drivers' legal work authorizations were short-term or non-existent.
Violating federal law and endangering American families.
That's how he framed it.
Yeah.
It's a serious national security and safety lapse.
And New York's response.
New York State is fighting back immediately. The DMV spokesperson called Duffy's warning a lawless act and a desperate attempt to distract from the failing chaotic administration. They assert that every CDL they issue complies with federal rules.
So it's another clear flashpoint where federal authority clashes with state jurisdiction using funding threats as the weapon.
Exactly.
Finally, let's wrap up with the economic stability and key benefits for key constituencies that were impacted on Friday.
We mentioned the market shock earlier, but let's confirm the drivers. The S&P 500 fell 1.1% and the Dow dropped 0.5% on December 12th.
And the two key drivers were the regulatory risk from the proxy advisor EO targeting ESG,
which caused a capital flight and continued tech sector weakness driven by investor skepticism over the AI boom following disappointing Broadcom guidance earlier in the week.
The market was also digesting the Federal Reserve's move.
A significant action signaling a strategic shift. The Fed executed a 25 basis point rate cut.
The third consecutive cut.
It is. And this signals a definite shift in priority. The Fed is moving from focusing primarily on fighting inflation to actively supporting the labor market and ensuring economic growth continues.
And the Fed's projections suggest they anticipate achieving a soft landing.
They do, with 2026 GDP growth forecasted at a healthy 2.3%.
On the benefits side, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS, guidance mandating states track beneficiary employment for Medicaid eligibility continues to cause significant concern.
This new policy, which resulted from the Working Families Tax Cut legislation, mandates that states implement systems to track beneficiary employment hours to maintain Medicaid eligibility.
And health policy experts warn this will lead to massive disenrollment.
Because the complexity and red tape of reporting requirements often trip up low-income beneficiaries, causing them to lose coverage not because they are ineligible, but because they fail to file the paperwork correctly.
And it threatens to crash state IT systems already struggling with capacity,
resulting in chaotic coverage losses.
But in contrast to the uncertainty surrounding Medicaid, Friday brought significant certainty and good news for veterans.
Yes. President Trump signed three key bills bolstering veteran support. These signings are important markers of support for the military community.
The first one was H.R. 970.
The Fairness for Service Members and Their Families Act. This indexes service members and veterans group life insurance death benefits to the Consumer Price Index, or CPI.
Protecting the purchasing power of these crucial benefits against inflation.
Then there was H.R. 983. The Montgomery GI Bill, Selected Reserves Tuition Fairness Act.
This mandates in-state tuition rates for members of the selected reserves at public institutions, regardless of their residency.
For many reservists, this removes a major financial barrier to higher education, helping recruitment and retention dramatically.
And the third bill addresses a painful problem: financial fraud against vulnerable veterans.
H.R. 1912, the Veteran Fraud Reimbursement Act, a critical consumer protection measure. It requires the VA to immediately reimburse veterans defrauded by VA-appointed fiduciaries,
shifting the risk of collection from the vulnerable veteran to the government,
which is better equipped to pursue legal action against the fraudsters.
So what does this all mean? We have navigated an exhaustive account of executive, legislative, judicial, and administrative actions that occurred on December 12th.
The volume alone is remarkable.
But the pattern is even more telling.
The granular actions of Friday, December 12th, illustrated government pulling in intensely different directions. On one side, you have an executive branch prioritizing flexibility and ideological purity in defense, immigration, and finance,
even at the expense of global norms and established state rights,
evidenced by the AI preemption and the removal of state veto power on pipelines.
And on the other side, the courts are trying to keep pace by continually defining the outer limits of that executive power on issues of fundamental liberty.
Whether it's the use of ethnicity in immigration stops, the right to self-identification on government documents, or the limits of military deployment within domestic cities.
It felt less like normal governance and more like a series of ideological skirmishes designed to set constitutional precedents.
Exactly. The underlying theme is a relentless push for central federal regulatory control to advance the administration's economic and political priorities. And it uses the massive apparatus of the federal government as a singular, unified tool.
And while Congress debates these huge structural issues, the impact hits the American worker and consumer immediately.
Whether it's the TSA officer losing union protections despite congressional efforts, the H-1B Reliant hospital facing a $100,000 fee for essential staff, or the millions bracing for a steep rise in health premiums because Congress remains deadlocked on the ACA subsidy extension.
This is where it gets really interesting. We are seeing a massive resurgence of the power of the courts,
especially through the controversial shadow docket as the ultimate arbiter of these aggressive policies.
Yes. And the core tension we saw playing out on December 12th, the conflict between aggressive federal security interests and states' rights, seen everywhere from the National Guard deployment battles to the AI regulation fight.
It raises an important question.
Which is?
In the face of these aggressive executive policies that states believe are illegal, like the passport gender marker rules or the $100,000 visa fee, will state-level officials focus on attempting difficult, compromised legislative fixes in Congress? Or will they increasingly rely on aggressive multi-state litigation, turning the courts into the primary battleground for federal policy in 2026?
That's a fascinating thought to chew on as we wrap up this deep dive. The choice between the legislative struggle and the judicial counterattack defines the year ahead. Thank you for walking us through this exhaustive account of the day's federal actions.
Always a pleasure.
Until next time, keep digging.